My name is Harriet Tramer, and I host this show, Reaching for the Gold, every other Tuesday afternoon at this time. We deal with all aspects of aging, and one part of aging is living with memories. Our first guest this afternoon, Deanna Adams, a writer, has written extensively about rock and roll memories, detailing a more innocent time when we baby boomers were captivated by music that spoke for our generation. Our second guest, Ellie Kovar, works as head of the Nazi Victims Unit for self-help, which works to keep seniors independent. Many of his clients are dealing with memories of a far less innocent or carefree type. Deanna, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Harriet. Thanks for having me.
How did you happen to start writing? Have you always wanted to be a writer, or why is that?
Well, it's interesting because I've always loved reading. And so, of course, when I was younger, I wanted to write stories that I was reading. And then, of course, I became a teenager, and pouring out my teenage angst through really bad poetry was, you know, really very helpful. Actually, I still have those poems, and some of them aren't so bad. But, it was just ingrained in me, you know, ever since I can remember.
Mm-hmm. You wrote,
of course, I took creative writing courses after that, you know, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
Mm-hmm. You write books that might be considered nostalgic about rock and roll, Buddy Holly. Why did you pick these topics instead of dealing with what is happening now? Tell us a little bit about some of your books that might be nostalgic, and why did you pick these?
Yeah, and actually, I think sometimes the book picks you. I know the first one, Rock and Roll and the Cleveland Connection, I was doing a lot of freelancing and writing a lot of articles on rock and pop culture because that's my interest. And we were getting the Rock, Cleveland was getting the Rock Hall around the same time it was opening. So I thought, you know, somebody should be documenting all this wonderful history. Even though I grew up in the area, there was still so much I didn't know until the more I read and talked to people, and I thought, boy, you know, this would make a great book. Of course, I didn't know it was going to end up being 600-some pages, and it took like 4 years to do, but I was really glad to have documented that history because I think we boomers are at an age where we're really fast. We lived through fascinating, changing times, and the music was monumental in our lives, and it's just really interesting to go back and remember all those, you know, bands that we remember and be able to know the backstories.
You say it was monumental for our times. I'm sure that's true. I lived through them also. Do you think it was more monumental for our times than it is for young people today?
Well, I think because young people have a lot of other distractions. Back when, you know, they have all that technology and so many other interests, we pretty much had sports and music. So if you weren't interested in sports, and of course there's the drama and the theater and everything, but music, you know, everybody had a transistor. So you could just, you know, you listened to the music then, and then they had the TV dance shows, and you were hearing music on TV and Ed Sullivan and all that. So really, no matter where you went, the music was going into your ear and your mind, and you were, you know, and it just became a part of, you know, growing up. And then, of course, as we got older, the radio got even better, and the DJs were, you know, especially in the early 70s, and where they could pretty much play what they wanted. So we were introduced to so many new bands and new music that it just really was entertaining. And, you know, I think all of us have our favorites music, probably because they were the soundtrack of our youth, you know, a soundtrack of our lives. And it still rings, if we hear a song today, it takes you right back to where you were at that time.
You say soundtracks of our lives. The operant word seems to be our.
Mm-hmm.
I see young people walking around all the time, and I don't mean this to be derogatory, it's just what's happening. They're listening to music probably as much as we ever did, but they're listening to an iPod. They're mm-hmm. listening to their own music, songs they picked. In a previous era, we were listening to what was coming from the radio. It was much more a communal experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, more intimate, because we really got to know the DJs, and the DJs informed us and educated us about the music. They always, we're going to play the song by, you know, this group, and this came out, and a lot of times, if you listen to the radio now, you get like 5 or 6 songs in a row, and you don't even know who's playing it. You're not being, you know the song, but a lot of times you don't even know who did it, because they don't mention it like they used to. At least
mm-hmm.
that's been my experience, and I've noticed that.
Were you very interested in rock and roll when you were young? You said you were interested in writing. Did you play an instrument? Was rock and roll a very important thing for you?
Well, it's funny because I didn't play an instrument. I never was that musical. But, again, I think because I had an older brother who introduced me very early on. And, of course, everybody remembers the Beatles and Ed Sullivan. And that really, that really set things in motion. But I was always kind of ahead of my age group because my older brother was bringing home all these records and playing them and bringing all the cute guys over to play in a band because he was in a band. So, rock and roll defined my youth for sure.
You mentioned Ed Sullivan. Now, that was the extreme communal experience. Not only did young people listen, but a whole family listened. Can you imagine such a thing today? The family, the parents, the children, maybe even a grandparent, sitting and watching the same TV show at the same time.
You are right about that, Harriet. Yeah, that's very true. And it's really sad in a way. But then again, we didn't have anything else to do. And we didn't always like what was on Ed Sullivan, but, our houses were smaller, too, I think. I mean, at least everyone I knew had... you can go in your bedroom, but, a lot of times people didn't have basements or their houses weren't so big where you could hole up and be in a whole other section of the house where, you could do your kind of your own thing. It was just a family time, really.
Mm-hmm. Have you found it easier to write as you age, or have you found that process to be more difficult? In other words, do you tend now to write something and then say, oh, that's not very good. What's wrong with me? Or do you tend to be more accepting of what you write? Does it come easier?
I don't think it ever comes easier just because, I like to challenge myself. So I'm always writing something different. After the first book, which was nonfiction, took a lot of researching and interviews, then I wrote Confessions of a Not-So-Good Catholic Girl, which was a memoir. So it was creative nonfiction. So it really was a different way of writing it. And then with my new book, Peggy Sue Got Pregnant, a rock and roll love story, that's a novel. So that was a whole nother challenge going from writing from nonfiction to fiction. So you're always, I think as a writer, you always want to learn more and get better. I never have writer's block. I don't even know what that is. I always have something that I want to write. It's the way that you write it, and that's the challenge of being, because there's so much aspects of writing, and it's hard. I mean, no matter what age you are. Some people think that it's easy and you just sit down and write, but you have to figure out, whether you write fiction or nonfiction, you have to write it well, you have to make it have something interesting to say, you have to say it in an entertaining way, you have to learn how to structure the story so it doesn't confuse the reader. There's so much involved.
Mm-hmm. When you started writing, I would imagine, I'm sure you didn't use a computer. A word processor.
Oh, right. That's for sure, yes. The good old typewriter. I have terrible penmanship, so I started typing very early on, and I remember as a teenager when I was writing all that crazy poetry, it was in my bedroom with my little typewriter, and I got my first computer, I think, 92. So, I was old school there for quite a while.
Do you think... writing with a computer, obviously, you have spell check. You can erase everything. That's easier. But do you think writing with a typewriter, do you think that made you really concentrate more? Do you think your writing may have been better at that part, more hard fought, more honest?
No, not really. I think actually the computer makes it so much easier. I don't rely on spell check, but I certainly rely on cut and paste, you know, because a lot of times you think, oh, this paragraph belongs further up or further down, you know, and then you have to find and replace so that, you know, if you're using too many adjectives, you can just find them and change the words. And, oh, you know, I can't even imagine writing a book, you know, with a typewriter anymore. I mean, it's just, and I couldn't have written the first one. I mean, I couldn't, there would have been no way to been able to write that volume, that huge volume, and the time that it took me to, it would probably would have taken me, you know, at least a decade.
I understand.
You know, so it does make it a lot easier.
Now, writing is one thing, and that comes easily for you. May not come easily for everybody, but you say it comes easily for you, and that's wonderful. Writing is one thing. Getting it published and out there is something else. Have you found that difficult? How have you managed to do that?
Well, it's interesting because all four of my books are from different publishers, and it's just because of the book it is. And it is very hard to get published, but it's not a new thing because everyone says, oh, nowadays it's so hard to get published. Well, it's always been hard to get published. And you do have the option now of self-publishing, but I really tried because I teach classes on what it takes to write a book, and I always tell my students, you know, if you self-publish, make sure that it's edited well, and you know, and it's great to be able to do it and have total control. But if it's not a good book and it's not written well, no one's going to buy it, no one's going to read it. So why bother? You know. So, and there's still that stigma there too, because a lot of writers that self-publish, they just want to get it out there. They don't take the time to make sure it's you know, a good book. But there are some great, you know, self-published books. So, you know, it all depends on the individual. You have a lot more options now. You know, each book is different. So, my novel took longer than my other books because it was a novel, and novels are hard. And it's really hard to try to sell a rock and roll novel as opposed to, you know, a young adult now that's a huge market romance is, and mine's a romance, but it's not a romance. there's just all these different genres that are much more popular and easier to publish than what I write. But I write what I love, you know, what excites me.
Now, you say you can self-publish. People publish whole novels over the internet. There's e-books. Has that made it harder for you to publish your novels, or easier?
You know, it's just a different way of going. And actually, most of my books, except the first one, is an e-book as well as in print. So it's actually you're reaching another audience because they're. And I always said it in the beginning when everyone says, oh, there's, you know, print books, are going away because everyone's going to be buying e-books. I never, you know, I'm a print book girl, you know, and I know a lot of people who prefer a real book. So you're always going to have those as opposed to the ones who just prefer to go on their Kindle or their Nook, and that's fine too. But they're going to coexist very nicely, I think. I don't see either one of them going away, and they're just going to be other avenues to read a book and to publish a book. There's our publishing companies now that are they only publish e-books, which is fine, you know. But then again, if you're able to get it out in both print and e-book, which mine are, you know, that makes it, you reach a wider audience, of course.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write again about a rock and roll time. What are some things that so stuck out in your mind during that period, probably about 65 to 77, around in there, that are just so much in your mind that you reflect back on them when you're writing? Are there memories you have that are just so specifically strong?
Yeah, they change. I mean, there's not any one or even a group of them. It depends on what I'm writing. When I was writing Confessions of a Not-So-Good Catholic Girl, and of course it's not just about being Catholic, it's about growing up as a baby boomer and, you know, black and white TV and everything that we grew up with and the psychedelic times and all that. So when I was writing that, it's a collection of stories, so I'd be writing one story and then things would pop up as you're writing them, that the memories would come up and go, oh, yeah, that's right. Wow, that really influenced me. Didn't think of it until I started writing it. And that's where, when people, especially with memoir, everyone says, you know, how do you remember that? Well, you don't always until you start writing it through. That's why journals are very, a lot of people love writing, in journals, because they either don't want to forget a time or they realize there's something in their life that was really important, and that had an effect on them. I hope that answers your question. I mean, you know, there's just so many memories, and especially the times that we grew up, everything was changing, everything was happening at the same time. You had, you know, the records, the different genres, and the TV was, you know, finally playing groups on TV, and just... you just had a lot coming at you, all at once, really, which made it exciting.
Well, you say everything was changing. Yeah, I'm sure you'll have some interesting thoughts on this. Things are changing faster now in terms of the technology. I mean, 5 years ago, Facebook wasn't. The technology was changing quickly then, but good heavens, not as fast. For example, when FM radio came in, late 60s, early 70s, yeah, people began switching, but it wasn't this surge in the sense that we have had a surge for iPhones, mobile devices, Facebook, any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think people's minds were changing faster then, even though the technology was not? What do you mean by changing so quickly?
Well, you know, again, the AM to the FM, Vietnam, they're also we were immersed in a war and the protests and the social unrest and things that you would see on TV, and TV was the huge thing because in the, 40s, people didn't have TV to catch up on what was happening in the world. And 50s, depending on, if you had one or you had this little TV, by the 60s, you really knew what was happening in the world and you would see it on TV. I mean, a lot of people remember when Kennedy died and his assassin, Jack Ruby? No, he was a shooter. But anyway, you saw him, Lee Harvey Oswald. He we actually watched him get killed on TV. That wasn't just a Western that we were watching. It was real life. So all this stuff was happening, and filling our heads and our lives really quickly. I think that's what it was, every time you turned around, something monumental was happening, something that was changing along with how we were changing and growing up and dealing with a lot of things that our parents didn't, there's World War II, but, as far as, just a lot of pop culture changes.
And when you get back to talking about these events, such as the assassinations, they were at that point, for lack of a better word, communal. In other words, there were just three major TV networks.
Mm-hmm.
You watch. Now, if there is a major event, people can go to their computer and watch streaming from the event itself. Even if that is not on the TV, they can watch CNN, they can watch MSNBC, they can watch PBS, they can watch the networks, they can watch any number of other cable stations. Yeah, they're finding out the same information, but good heavens, they are finding it out through different sources and in different ways and with a different bent.
Right. And it's hard to have one opinion on something anymore, too, because you're getting all those different opinion, sometimes it gets really confusing about how you really feel about something, you know. But the music's always there, and it's still, bottom line, it's history-making, because music is the sign of the times, and it shows a lot of, what's happening in the world, and of course the songs emulate what's happening in the world, and the feeling, it's very important, and I think it really affects everybody, no matter what generation you come from. You know, our parents had big bands. That was influential. We had rock and roll, among other genres, and of course now you've got, so many different
you got everything.
Ways to enjoy it, yeah. Which is,
everything.
You know, great.
Somebody can have thousands of songs on their iPod.
Yeah. And all different, and that, that's good. It kind of expands our world, And even rock,
It doesn't expand our world. It expands their world.
Yeah, right. And that's what I'm,
It's very different. Yeah. Now, what do you plan to continue writing? Do you have any ideas for future books?
You know, well, I cannot not write because, that's just who I am and what I do for a living. But right now I've been trying to, because we've had some, a lot of different things happening in life, and life gets in the way. But I am contracted to do to write a sequel to Peggy Sue Got Pregnant, and take her daughter into, because she's like a Joan Jett, singer, and take her into through the 80s and early 90s, and that's fun too because I get to revisit MTV and all that. So I'm in the midst of writing that as well as other things that I do. So. This morning is really the time that when everything's quiet, when I could really get into the other world. And that's like you were saying about memories and what you remember. You get into that world and you kind of relive it. It's kind of fun.
Now, one thought is that great literature has something about it that transcends its time. In other words, Shakespeare wrote when he wrote, we read Shakespeare now, by many people's interpretations, there's some internal truth that mean as much today as they would have at any point. I'll let you give yourself a real plug. What in your books might be an internal truth that somebody coming along 100 years from now can pick it up and say, Diana Adams, she wrote about this, wow. It's not just about Peggy Sue and rock and roll. It's about people, and it spans over the years. What in your books would you say captures that?
Well, I think the first one, and why I felt it was so important to do, is because it does go through a lot of history of, but it's about music and people. So it talks about the bands and how they were influenced by the ones who came before them, and that's still happening. And it documents history, music history in a fun and entertaining way, and but addresses also the fact that how music does affect everybody's lives one way or another, and how you can go back and hear a song on the radio and go be 17 again, if only for 2 minutes. The Peggy Sue book, the issues that I brought, because especially novels, I think it's you shouldn't just write to write. You should have something to say, and I wanted to address the fact that in 1957, if a girl became pregnant, a young girl at 16, they sent her, the parents, she was ostracized, and they sent her away to an unwed mother's home, or, out, just because she would be an embarrassment to the family, as opposed to nowadays where it's not a huge deal like it was, and it's totally different than it was back then. And I wanted to address that as long, and how it ended up becoming a feminism issue, by the time Roe versus Wade came and all that. So, and all kinds of other themes as well plays into that book. I wanted to kind of do like a Forrest Gump kind of book where you take fictional characters and weave them through historic times. And address some of the issues and some of the historic events that happened, and that's kind of what my goal was to writing that book. And the Confessions book is just, you know, my take on how we grew up. And, sure, they're my stories, but I really wrote them with the reader in mind, the baby boomer reader in mind. And I've gotten a lot of great feedback saying, you know, I so remember that. And, oh, you know, I totally forgot about this until I read your book. And, you know, what a time that was and how different it is today. And because history, I love history. I love music and history, and that's what I write about, whether it's nonfiction or fiction.
And you think somebody reading your book 100 years from now will say, hey, I learned something not only about people in general, but about that time. Is that a goal of yours?
I hope so. I think that that's my goal, you know, to do that, because it does, everything I write about does reflect a certain era and how people think, you know, how closed-minded a lot of people were back, you know, in the 50s and 60s as opposed to now in certain ways. And, you know, it just really like to, and I use a lot of details in my book just to make sure that that reader can really feel like they're back in time and just how people react to certain situations that they would totally react differently today. So it's a challenge, but it's also fun. And, you know, I like to write about that era because of the times were, in some ways, were simpler. You know, things were a little more black and white back then, in some cases, than they are now. A lot of
the
gray
TV
areas.
Was more black and white. That's for sure.
Yeah, that too. So and that fits right in. You know, so because things are a lot more complex, and you know, there's arguments to that because things were complex back then. But in so many ways, because of technology, things have gotten really a lot more complex, and you know, there's just so many options in every shape and form, you know.
Deanna, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, it was great talking to you. I can chat with you for hours, Harriet. Thank you. You were great questions, and hopefully you'll have me on again sometime. Maybe
thank
the next
you.
Book, huh? Thank you.
Our second guest, as I mentioned, is Ellie Cover, who works as head of the Nazi Victims Unit for Self-Help. This group works to keep seniors independent. Many of its clients that Mr. Kovar works with specifically are dealing with memories of a far less innocent or carefree type than those Deanna Adams, the rock and roll historian, discussed. Welcome to the show, Ellie.
Thank you. Thank you.
How was self-help form? How did this happen?
Okay. Well, Self-Help Community Service was formed actually in 1936, so it's a 77-year-old organization. It was founded by emigres from Nazi Germany who were actually fleeing from Nazi oppression, and those that were able and lucky enough to be able to get out came to the United States. And in New York, German refugees who had preceded them kind of formed a self-help group to welcome newcomers to the city. They also were raising funds to help try to get other people out from Germany. When the refugees came here, of course, they needed what all new arrivals need. They needed a place to stay. They needed housing. They needed somebody to make sure that the children got into school. And, of course, they needed employment. So those are the areas that self-help was very first, from its inception, was involved with. The employment area is very interesting because if the people who were coming over were professionals, they couldn't work right away. If they were doctors or lawyers in Germany, they obviously could not practice here. But the women, of course, could work immediately. They could take care of babies. They could take care of children. They could take care of old people. So one of the main areas that self-help was involved with was an employment service, which was primarily a home care employment service. So now, 77 years later, Self-Help's the largest organization serving Holocaust survivors in North America. The organization has grown to do much more than that. As you mentioned just before, the mission is for Self-Help to be able to keep people at home, living independently, you know, as to the best that we can. We serve about 20,000 individuals with a range of services, but we still retain this core mission of serving Holocaust survivors and victims of Nazi persecution. And of the 20,000 clients that Self-Help serves annually, about 25% last year, 5,300 of those individuals were Holocaust survivors,
which we serve in distinct programs that we operate just for Holocaust survivors. We keep that unit separate because it's got a very distinct client population and because we raise and receive funds for that population, so we want to make sure that we have a very segregated, very clear delineation of these programs that serve Holocaust survivors.
What you tell me is amazing. You said 1936. The United States did not get into the war until about 5 years after that. Wasn't it terribly difficult for these people to try to raise funds if the American public was not really yet involved in the war effort? Weren't many people even denying the United States would ever have to get involved in that effort?
Well, what's interesting is that the name self-help, and we spell it with one word, S-E-L-F, lowercase H-E-L-P, it's spelled in one word, which is how you would spell it in German, where you put two words together to make a new noun, and so you know, it comes directly from the German. So it indeed was a self-help effort. It was all volunteers, all right? There were no paid staff. And what they were doing was they were going from door to door to all the refugees who were here, and as the new ones came over and started working, and they were basically collecting money from their own group. They were not getting government funds. They were not getting even, I don't think, much support from the general community at large. They were raising money themselves to bring their countrymen out from Germany at that point. It was, you know, and it was all, nobody knew that there was even going to be a Holocaust. They just knew that life was extremely difficult in Germany. And then after Germany, then in, you know, in Austria and Czechoslovakia. So the first name was actually self-help for, you know, refugees from Germany. And then it became self-help for emigres from Central Europe. And then finally, some years later, became self-help community services when we started providing services to the community at large, which began in the 1960s. When we had had expertise, we had gained expertise in working with Holocaust survivors, most of whom we were serving were older people because the younger survivors were going to work, creating new families. You know, the miracle actually of the survivors is not just that they survived the Holocaust, but that having done that, they then basically created new lives for themselves. Those who had lost entire families started over again, and they came to the United States. They went elsewhere, of course, to Israel and other countries as well. But in the United States, they became American citizens. They worked their whole life. They raised families. Their children, as a group, are a fairly successful group of second generation. But that's the amazing story of survival, is that against all odds, as one author put it, against all odds, Holocaust survivors came and really made new lives for themselves. But now, in their old age, now, you know, 60-some-odd years after the end of the war, when it's a time for reflection, you know, old age and, you know, psychological theory, old age is the time to look back, to not just to reminisce, but to review your life, to see what's happened, you know, and to make a, I guess, a conclusion to the circle of your life. For Holocaust survivors, the time of reflection and looking back brings them back to a period in which there was a significant trauma, a, you know, and one might call it a black hole in somebody's life history. And so life review and reminiscence for survivors often engenders a rekindling of the trauma, loss of independence as one gets older and has debilitating conditions, loss of independence, while for any older person, you know, has severe consequences. People, you know, become depressed. People need care, and accepting care is a difficult step. For Holocaust survivors, it's even more so because of their life experience, because of the cause of many of their physical ailments. In later life, the cause could be traced back to the Holocaust. But the rekindling of memories of loss and of trauma as their age group, as their cohorts, as their spouses pass away, it just rekindles all of these losses and separation and brings back the trauma You know, and when I say brings it back, it's not just brings it back in memory, but it brings it back into the present. And sometimes older survivors tend to be caught up in living the life that existed 60-some-odd years ago, which causes some difficulties, as you might imagine, in their functioning in today's world.
You talk about the memories that come back on them. We hear a lot nowadays about post-traumatic stress syndrome and treatment for it, for some people who were in Afghanistan or Iraq. Do you think some of these people would have benefited greatly and may not have some of the trauma they do now if they had had treatment for post-traumatic stress syndrome? Or is it just such a totally different thing that that doesn't apply?
I'm not an expert to say that it's totally different. I mean, I think there are certainly differences. All of these situations are engender extreme trauma, and to be fighting in a war or to have done things that you regret later on, but to see things happen to your fellow soldiers, it's just awful situations to be in. Likewise for survivors, what they went through, there was total no control on their part, and everything was done to them. So it's a slightly different, just a different way that the trauma comes about. But I can imagine that what the people live with are the same debilitating psychological consequences of that. I've heard reference that the Holocaust experience, and perhaps this relates to anybody with PTSD, but the experience is like a radioactive toxin. And the event took place, or the events, you know, we talk about the Holocaust and it rolls off our tongues in, 10 seconds, the word is the Holocaust. But to imagine every day, for 4 or 5 years, every day, every minute of every day to be living in that fear of the unknown. And of course, we at this stage know what happened. We know the end of the story, but to be living it for 4 or 5 years without any sense of what the end of the story was going to be, other than most likely your own death, it brings it to a different level of understanding. But this toxin, this experience becomes like a toxin, and kind of like a radio, like in the nuclear reactor in Japan, where they had the accident several years ago. The toxin goes into the air and it goes into the earth, and the event happened, but where the toxin will come out, in Japan it comes out in the food, it comes out in the spinach that's being grown miles away. So in a similar way, the toxin from the Holocaust gets buried. People make these new lives, but how it comes out is remains to be seen. And so it can come out in the relationship between survivors and their children, both positive relationship or in negative ways. We don't know how it will come out. It can seep through to other generations. And then 60 years after the war, the toxin from the Holocaust seeps out, because the survivor is no longer struggling to work. When they first came here, they had to make a new life. They had to work. They had to take care of their children. They were busy. They buried it. They buried the issues. Nobody in this country wanted to hear about it. Mostly people said, that was then. You're in America now. Get on with your life. Forget about it. And actually, survivors probably wanted to forget about it themselves, and they believed that they could forget about it if they just worked hard enough and made a new life and had new children, they could forget about it. But now, some years later, decades later, this toxin comes out in various ways when there is a trigger for it. If a spouse passes away, it rekindles the trauma of losing their family members. If they become debilitated and all of a sudden they need care and they can no longer physically do what they used to do, it brings back the memory of what did it mean during the Holocaust to not be physically able to do work. Well, if you couldn't work in the concentration camp, you were killed, right? not being able to work, not being healthy, was a death sentence. So if that's what comes back now for an older survivor who is not capable of managing their life, not capable of doing the work that they need to do, it brings up issues that don't exist for other older people when they become debilitated. And so I think this toxin comes out in very, very different ways for different people, but it is this sense of overwhelming living in fear, this overwhelming sense of events being out of control, of not being able to manage your life, and possible death sentence.
What you're bringing up, what came across to me just really strong, is you have these experiences and have these experiences in you that others around you simply don't understand.
Right.
If there has been immediately some terrible trauma, like there might have been with a tsunami or an earthquake, everybody around you is experiencing them. If these things are coming back at you from horrible experiences of decades ago, other people around you do not understand them, and you probably don't feel real comfortable discussing them because you realize that fact.
Right. That's correct.
That would be very difficult.
Right.
Now,
okay. Well,
if somebody is in that position, what can your organization do for them?
Well, so we have this specialized program. We have 7 offices in different locations in New York City and Nassau County, which is a nearby suburban county, with large numbers of survivors. Last year, we served 5,300 Holocaust survivors. We have 45 to 50 social workers, trained social workers, who work with these clients. The goal is first to make sure that they are getting all the care that they need, all the benefits, entitlements that they are entitled to just by virtue of being an older person in New York City. And in addition, that they get all the specialized services and benefits that may be available to them because they're Holocaust survivors. We build what we do based on the relationship between the social worker and the survivor. That sometimes can take a long time to build that trusting relationship. But we, because we are designed the program this way, we are able to spend as much time as we need to help us make that relationship with the individual. And then basically they become a client, they become connected to us for as long as they want, which for most people is till they pass away, which could be years. We've had clients for many, many years. The amazing thing is that we keep getting new clients. Of the 5,300 clients we served last year, well over 1,000 were new people who didn't know us, who'd never been to us before, people in their 80s and 90s. The average age of our clients is about 85. The
85.
Right. The average age of our clients. That's correct. The average age of Holocaust survivors in general now is about 81. So we still see a group of people who will age into the need for our services. There will be more people coming in the coming years, which is an interesting fact. I mean, because it's true that survivors as a population are declining day by day, but it's not a rapid decline. It's steady, but it's not precipitous. But what's happening is that as survivors get older and people are living longer, there are more people in need of care. So even though it's an aging population and the population is in decline, there is not as steady a decline in the number of people needing service. So right now, there are probably somewhere between 65,000 to 67,000 survivors in New York City. This is based on a population study that the UJA Federation here in New York just completed of the Jewish population of 2011. And in 2011, the study indicated there were 73,000 Holocaust survivors in New York City and the 3 suburban counties closest to us. So if you account for attrition and morbidity over the past 2 years, there would today be somewhere between 65 to 67,000 survivors. We did our own report then that projected that population out through the year 2025. And even in the year 2025, there will still be over 23,000 survivors in New York City and those three suburban counties, which is a tremendous number. New York City has about 65% of the survivors in the entire United States live in New York City, and the three other counties just contiguous to us. So it's of about 110,000 or 120,000 survivors in the United States, 67,000 of them are living in the New York City area. So it's really a large population that is not going to disappear very quickly. And the services that we provide now, we will continue to be needing to provide for the coming years. And so we do these services based on social work. As I explained before, we have social workers who work with clients developing an individual relationship, and the goal being to help the person stay at home. We have other services that are direct for them. We talked about survivors having a unique experience that most other people don't understand in the same way. And that comes out and can be seen because many survivors are not that comfortable in socializing with the community at large, but will socialize with other survivors. So we run over 100 what we call coffee house programs. They're actually social events where survivors come together in groups of 60, 70, 80, sometimes 100 people will come to a gathering where we have some music, we have a little bit of food, we have our social workers there, and the survivors are sitting around tables, talking to each other, enjoying the entertainment, sometimes dancing. The goal is twofold. One is it provides an opportunity for people to come together, which is a social activity, which is a very, very good thing. They will socialize with other survivors, but it brings them out of their house. It gets them out into the community, and where we normally see people in home visits, where they are talking about their problems and their issues, when they come to the gatherings, they're dressed up, they're in their minds, and it's true, we call them social events. They call them parties because that's what they really are. They'll come together, but they'll be dressed up, and they'll have a smile on their face, or they'll hum along to the music, and it gives them an outlet. We had a client once who told us, you know, when I take about 12 different medicines every single day, but, you know, on the days when I come to the social events, to the party, the day when I come here, I really don't even need to take my medicine because this one doesn't have any side effects. So it just provides a moment of happiness and enjoyment in what can be a maybe not such a happy and joyful existence.
What you say is amazing. You say 85. The average age in the United States is 80.
Is that 80, 81? The average age of our clients is 85. Yeah.
I understand that. I mean, the average age that people live to. But that's amazing because these are people who have physically and emotionally been through a very, very great deal.
Well, it is incredible. I mean, in our last year when we did our analysis for our own client population, 58% of our clients were over the age of 85.
That's amazing.
Right. So, numbers, I think, in the 20s of the number of people who were over 100. So, and I don't know, you know, what it is that makes for this longevity. Because clearly there are many people who have passed away already. I don't know, you know, we don't know what ages they passed away at. But some of it is that either these people were strong, physically stronger in some ways. It's also, I think, people are living longer in this country in general. But we have a very, very aged population of Holocaust survivors that we serve. And, of course, of the younger survivors, there are those who did survive as children. But if somebody was, you know, 10 years old in 1945, you know, we're now almost 70 years after the war, right? 1945 till now would be, you know, 60-some-odd years after the war. 68 years after the war. So if they were 10, they're now 78. So that's the younger side of the survivors, you know, are, you know, 78, 76.
Mr. Cover, thank you very, very much for being our guest today. My name is Harriet Tramer, and I hope you'll listen every other Tuesday at this time to our show. And go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/justwantotalk1. facebook.com/justwantotalk1. Or check out our page here at BBS Radio, which is bbsradio.com/reachingforthegold. Thank you.